Hey, thanks for listening to Sprawlcast. Just a reminder that the Sprawl is crowdfunded by Calgarians. So if you like what you hear, please sign up as a supporter. You can do that at www.patreon.com/SprawlCalgary.
The next stop, Sprawlcast.
Hey, Happy New Year. My name is Jeremy Clausus, and I'm the founder and editor of The Sprawl, and you're listening to Sprawlcast. The show is a collaboration between The Sprawl and CGSW 90.9 FM, and we are podcasting in Calgary on the traditional territories of the people of Treaty 7. Sprawlcast is a show for curious Calgarians who want more than the daily news grind. And we're going to begin 2019 by looking at the challenge of journalism in polarized times.
Hi, this is Amanda.
Hey there, Amanda. It's Jeremy Clausus calling from The Sprawl in Calgary.
How you doing, Jeremy?
Good. How are you?
I'm great.
This is Amanda Ripley, and she's an American journalist and author. She writes for places like The Atlantic, The New York Times, and Slate. And recently, she's been working on a different kind of investigation. She's been investigating journalism itself. She's really been asking, what is the role of the journalist in a very politically polarized climate? Amanda's work caught my attention because she wrote an article all about how journalists can do their jobs better, how they can listen more, and also how they can handle conflict in a healthy way rather than just escalating it. I want to read to you from that article, just a little excerpt. Here's what Amanda writes, and she's talking about journalists here. Again and again, we have escalated the conflict and snuffed the complexity out of the conversation. Long before the 2016 U.S. election, the mainstream news media lost the trust of the public, creating an opening for misinformation and propaganda. If the purpose of journalism is to see the public into fuller existence, as Jay Rosen once wrote, it's hard to conclude that we are succeeding. Now, she's obviously writing about the American situation, but there are a lot of parallels to what's happening in Canada. And with two elections coming up this year, both the provincial and the federal election, I think it's super timely stuff. And it's not just a conversation for journalists either. I think we've all had that experience where we go to talk to somebody about a controversial issue, and they just dismiss you out of hand, and you're at loggerheads, and you can't break through, and there's a real sense of frustration. And if social media is any indication of how we're going to have conversations in Alberta before this next election, wow, we're in trouble. But as Amanda found, there are different ways to have conversations in a climate like this.
So one of the stranger things that I got to do for this project was to visit a place called the Difficult Conversations Lab at Columbia University in New York. And this is a place where a researcher named Peter Coleman and his team have hosted and recorded 500 tense, awkward conversations between strangers who wildly disagree on some controversial subject, like, you know, peace in the Middle East or abortion. And they do this so they can figure out what makes a difference between high-quality conversations and really, like, negative, stuck, unsatisfying debates. And one of the things they figured out, which I think is really cool and definitely relevant to all journalists and many other people, is that they can actually induce better quality conversations pretty simply by having people, before they go in for their difficult conversation, they have people read a short news story that is written in a complicated way. So instead of a story about, some controversial subject, let's say the death penalty here in the U.S., with one side pro and one side against, they do the same story, but in a more nuanced way. So they explain, you know, that there's many different points of view on this. Here's how these different points of views have developed and changed over time. It's a complicated issue. And what they find is when people read the same facts written in this more sophisticated, complicated way, they tend to have better quality conversations. So what this means is they still get frustrated with the other person that they disagree with, but then they also feel moments of curiosity and understanding or even humor. And so they have these much more engaging, satisfying conversations, which, you know, I think is ultimately all we want people to do, right? We don't want people to agree. We don't want people to, or to avoid conflict. We want conflict to be interesting and helpful and useful, as opposed to what I think it's become, particularly in politics, which is destructive and also boring often. So I think that's good for no one. But so it does seem like from what they found that complexity can, when people encounter complexity, they become more curious and more open to new information. So that has obvious implications for anyone working in conflict or on controversial issues.
Speaking of the way we have conversations, I actually interviewed Amanda in person in November. I met her in New York City because we were there for a workshop about this very thing, about 25 journalists gathered to talk about how we could complicate the narrative in our stories and introduce more complexity and all that good stuff. Anyways, I tried to do this interview and it was in a loud area. There wasn't really an appropriate spot to do it, so it didn't work out. So Amanda very kindly let me do a phone interview afterward. And we're going to get back to that, but first I want to read just one more excerpt from her piece. She talks about how she's been a journalist for over 20 years and has kind of operated in a certain way. But once she started spending time with conflict mediation experts, her perspective changed. Here's what she writes. After spending more than 50 hours in training for various forms of dispute resolution, I realized that I've overestimated my ability to quickly understand what drives people to do what they do. I have overvalued reasoning in myself and others, and undervalued pride, fear, and the need to belong. I've been operating like an economist, in other words. An economist from the 1960s.
David Bornstein at the Solutions Journalism Network, he said to me, and this is how we got started on this project, he said, you know, economists used to believe that humans were rational actors, more or less, and that the marketplace would correct for mistakes over time. And eventually psychologists, people like Daniel Kahneman and others, convinced the field that they were wrong, that actually people make all kinds of predictable mistakes, and they have all kinds of cognitive biases, and that's what being human is all about. And so, you know, slowly and sometimes very reluctantly, economists changed their models, and now we have something called behavioral economics, right? And I think that journalism has not undergone this transformation. And I think there's a lot of reasons for this. It's a good question, you know, why have economists of all people been more attuned to human psychology than journalists.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think in some ways, to be fair, journalists have been very attuned to human psychology, right? Like, we know how to get people's attention quickly. We know how to make people feel frightened or sad or angry. We know about storytelling, and those are very important psychological levers. But I think we've been slower to realize how differently people behave in times of high conflict, when they're really entrenched and it feels like it's us versus them. Those kinds of polarizing moments require different rules of engagement. And I think that's where journalists have been slow to change, and not just journalists, but humans in general. And that's partly because, you know, it is easier in some ways, and it has worked for us in the past, to not change how we operate. So I think, you know, I think it has been slow, but I don't know if it's necessarily, I mean, look, I think all humans are bad at understanding how to deal in conflict, you know? And so we just thought we were good at it was our mistake, journalists.
And what do you think the journalist's role is amid conflict? 'Cause it's not, you know, to make everybody feel better or to ignore the differences that are there. And it seems like in some ways very tricky terrain when I look at it as a journalist and look at, okay, how do I put all of this into practice?
Right. I mean, our job is definitely not to make people agree or to make people feel better or to make conflict go away. You know, I think, though, that our job is to help people make sense of the world around them so that they can make good decisions, right? I think we could probably most journalists could agree on that.
Mm.
And so part of that, it turns out, is helping people make sense of conflict. So what happens to all people, including journalists, is that we tend to want to collapse into simplicity when we are feeling threatened or angry or really frustrated, right? So when we get into these us versus them conflicts, we have a lot of cognitive biases that make us exaggerate the other side's differences, and they make us feel like we have to attack or defend, and they do all kinds of things that happen that really distort the picture. So if journalists' job is to help people see clearly, then you have to understand how things get distorted in conflict.
Mm. And I like that once you identify that and name it, then you can actually do something about it, right? Then it's not just this knee-jerk thing that you're doing without thinking, but you can actually stop and be like, okay, how do I do this differently, right?
Right. And for a long time, you know, I was really interested in political polarization, and I would read all the research and the books, but it didn't feel like, it felt hopeless. It felt like, well, what are we supposed to do about this? And I actually think that's the wrong frame. Like, I think looking at it through the lens of conflict, which can be political, it can be personal, it can go on for, you know, hundreds of years. It can be with your neighbor or your spouse. When you look at it that way and you look at all the research that we can find around this, then I actually think it makes a lot more sense. So like you said, we really have to identify it and name it before we can begin to see it clearly.
Mm-hmm. You have in your piece, you have this delightfully provocative line here that I want to read out. You say the problem is that in a time of high conflict, coherence is bad journalism, bordering on malpractice. And you talk about how, you know, as journalists, we tend to get rid of complexity. We tend to cut out the stuff that doesn't fit with our stories. And we've all had that experience where we've got a story in our head and we go out and we start doing research and maybe we're towards the end of it and somebody says something that totally ruins everything that we've written, totally undermines it. And it's the most inconvenient thing ever, right? And you're saying, let that in. You're saying, let that illuminate what you're writing about. Far from, don't just ignore it, like put that at the center. Are you finding, are people receptive to that?
Yeah, it's very counterintuitive. Like when you're, as a journalist, like it, you're totally right. Like it happens in every story. Somewhere along the line, you find a study or someone says something that like really, really, you can actually feel it physically, like in your body. Like you can feel this like, sort of like a queasiness.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The fun, we all know it. We've all been there, yeah.
Yeah, you're like, oh, crap. But you can quickly justify not including it. Like it's very easy to do. And that's how we're all wired, right? Like you let your intuition lead, and then you justify your intuition with reasoning. And we're really good at that, right? So we can come, well, you know, the study was not randomized, so I'm just going to, you know, I don't trust it. Or this person has some kind of, you know, grudge, or which, you know, of course, everyone does. And so I'm just going to ignore what he said. Because the truth is, readers cannot handle too much complexity, right? Like, no one can. There needs to be some coherence. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, I think the trick is when people are already really dug in and they're already, you know, very reactive and very convinced they are right and the other side is evil, bringing people more coherence at that moment is not helpful and actually harmful, because what we know is that people on both sides will walk away from that story even more entrenched, right? So it doesn't have any impact, and the impact it has is negative and not actually aligned with reality. So I think it's hard to do, and it's taking, I mean, I'm still working on it. You know, I'm writing a story right now where there are lots of things that don't fit, and I'm trying to lean into that complexity to not be a hypocrite, right, and to insert some of that into the story. But then, you know, you also, at the end, you have to come back out the other side with some coherence. So you have to complicate and then simplify again, but still end up in a more complicated place than you started, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a balancing act, for sure. One of my big struggles with this whole thing, and I feel like I've been wrestling with it for months, and before that, even before I read your piece, I feel like your piece kind of gave language to a bunch of the stuff that was in the back of my mind, but I wasn't sure how to articulate. But one of my big questions, and I still don't have an answer for it, is how do you do all this? So how do you complicate the narrative? How do you create these conversations? How do you ask better questions without creating a false equivalency between people who are on different sides of a debate? Because, you know, we're talking about, in America and in Canada, very moral, serious issues. And is there a risk that gets lost, that we minimize perils that should be identified, frankly, as such, and they kind of get lost in this mamby-pamby, let's have a conversation and all listen to each other?
This definitely keeps me up at night, for sure. I don't want to be, unintentionally or not, I don't want to be creating false equivalences or ignoring sort of overt acts of crimes or acts of, you know, dehumanizing behavior. I think what I've been trying to do is to be really conscious of what my goal is in any given situation. So it's going to change depending on the goal. If your goal is you're interviewing someone privately, not on air, and you disagree totally with them and they're saying some really offensive things, if your goal is to understand how they got to believe the things they believe, then you're going to want to really resist the urge to argue with them. Mm. You will not convince them ever that they are wrong. So, you know, it doesn't help. You don't have to agree with them. You shouldn't. I mean, that would be lying, right? But asking them questions and proving to them that you're really listening, asking them different kinds of questions, like, you know, how did you come to feel this strongly about this? And help me understand this, because what you're saying contradicts with so many other things I've read, and, you know, kind of making yourself an ally of theirs. Like, this is a different way of going about that conversation than if you're literally trying to persuade someone that you have a long relationship with, you know, your uncle who you have, you know, huge political disagreements with. That person knows you and you know them, and there might be some trust there, right? And you can talk about your own experiences and he can talk about his experiences. That's a different goal.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If you're on air, if you're having a live interview with a politician and they say something you know to be false, you have two audiences there. You have the politician and you have the audience listening, and your loyalties are really to the audience listening, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're, in that case, trying to do something different. You're trying to make sure that this politician doesn't sort of perpetuate a falsehood. So the goal shifts, right? And you have to be conscious of what your goal actually is. What I think happens more often than not is that journalists do end up making things worse, but it's not in this way. Much more often, they end up making things worse by not asking open-ended questions, by not being curious, by thinking they can persuade when they can't. and misunderstanding how human beings actually behave.
Mm.
So there's risks all around, in other words, right? And they're big and hard challenges for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to describe it yesterday to somebody. It's like standing on this little tiny sliver of land, and you step one way and you fall off, you step the other way, you fall off. That's what it feels like. I feel like that's what journalism is like in this political climate in 2018. And
yeah, and it can be paralyzing, right?
Absolutely.
You know, like, I'll be in my head, I'll have all these different constituents, like people. Well, if I say this, then people on the left will freak out. If I say this, then people on the right will stop reading. If I say, and then you can make yourself crazy, you
mm-hmm.
know. So,
oh yeah, you
it's,
can.
It's really important to almost, you know, write down the goal. Like, what is the goal here, and be very loyal to that goal.
Mm-hmm. And for you, I mean, what is that goal when you're writing about? Let's say you're writing about American politics. You're writing about. I don't know, Trump voters in Nebraska, for example. What would your goal be? Or do you know, or is it piece by piece? Or
I think it's piece by piece and publication by publication.
Mm.
Because unfortunately, we've gotten so segregated politically that I know I have a different audience if I write for the Wall Street Journal, or if I write for Time Magazine, or if I write for The Atlantic. So, you know, I'm trying to think about what kind of assumptions and anxieties my readers are bringing to the story, but you can't get too caught up in that, right? So I think my fundamental goal, I'm not a beat reporter, so I don't need to be like, you know, I don't have to convey everything that happens. So my goal is really to reignite curiosity, to do that clear-eyed, not create curiosity where there shouldn't be any. I mean, there are things that are simple, right? Like, when Donald Trump lies, which he does every day, that's not complicated.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reasons he does it and the reasons so many people believe him, that's complicated. And that's actually really interesting to me. And I am curious about that. And I think we all should be.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that what he's saying is false is not that complicated. So, it's important not to let my own, you know, emotional reaction to someone like Trump drive my reporting, and be very conscious of how I'm feeling and how that's affecting my work, and trying always to remain curious.
Yeah, it's interesting hearing you say that. It just makes me realize, you know, to be curious in this climate is risky. That's probably true for anybody. But maybe especially for a journalist, because exactly all the things you mentioned, where you can get overthinking this stuff, and oh, this will upset this group of people or this group of readers.
So what is the risk? Is Jeremy? I'm curious. Like, the risk is, how does it feel?
Yeah, that's a good question. Like, what is that risk exactly? For me, I think it's that I will let something pass that should be challenged. That's what, to me, I'm conscious of or worried about.
And what will happen if you let something pass that should be challenged and you don't challenge it?
Well, among other things, get pilloried on social media. I mean, it depends what the context is, right?
Totally. That's a real risk.
Yeah.
Especially now, like if you miss something or fail to be conscious of how something's going to come across,
mm-hmm.
you will hear about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, what I guess my comeback would be, what's the risk of not being curious right now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
like, if we agree there's a risk in being curious, like, surely there's a risk in being not curious, right?
Totally. Yeah. And it would be a far greater risk to our community, where we know less about each other, have even less understanding. And you mentioned, like, that journalists, we know instinctively how to pull those psychological levers, how to get people outraged or how to get people worked up. Like, we can almost do that without thinking. You know, we find something somebody said or whatever it is. And we all know how to play that game. And those...
It feels safer.
It feels safe. There's not a whole lot of risk associated with that. Mm-hmm. Whereas the stuff you're talking about, it's like, how do you walk this? How do you walk this line without falling off either side? And that's what I really appreciated, actually, about the workshop in New York. It was funny because I came home. You know, I go to this workshop in New York. I'm in the room with you and 25 other journalists and these conflict mediation experts, and we're in there for 2 days. And I come home and I'm thinking, I don't know if I got any answers per se. I felt like I'm more left with a deepening of the questions almost. And maybe that's all one needs in this climate. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I found it, I agree, we didn't answer the questions. I did find it reassuring that there were so many other people there. I mean, granted, there were like many millions of journalists not there, but, you know, you sometimes feel like you're the only one grappling with these issues. And maybe, you know, maybe it's me. Maybe I'm just like overly contrarian, or I'm too, you know, I'm not like thinking clearly. So when there's other people and we're all kind of, we know there's a better way to do this. I think that, and we're just trying to figure out what it is. That's reassuring.
Absolutely.
But I think, you know, I really like the way you put this, that there's risk and curiosity, and I feel it. Like as I'm writing, I can imagine the tweets, right? Like I'm pre-drafting them in my head. And the truth is, I am going to make mistakes. I think a very close sibling of curiosity is humility. And I would say that both are really absent from the current political discourse and from way too many stories. So maybe the way to go forth is to say, you know what? I'm going to screw up. Like, I'm going to try my best, and I'm going to screw up. And people are going to tweet at me and call me whatever, and I'm going to have to take accountability and say I'm sorry, or say, you know, I respectfully disagree. But but maybe if nobody tweets at us, maybe that is not a victory.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe we've just taken the safe, easy path, right?
Right, because, you know, we know how to do that. We can all, both of us could, with our, you know, one hand tied behind our back, write a story that would get shared on social media, and would, like, get, you know, all these people would be like, right on, and we wouldn't be adding anything to the conversation.
Awesome. Well, thanks very much for this, Amanda. Lots to think about.
Great talking to you, Jeremy. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
End of line. Thanks for listening, and see you again soon.
You've been listening to Sprawlcast. And hey, if you like the show, please take time to leave a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to this podcast. It does help a lot if you do that small thing. Our theme music is by Dan D'Agostino and Kenny Murdoch. I actually finally met Dan D'Agostino. I've said his name like so many times over the last year. Dan D'Agostino. But I met him at Christmas, so that was kind of cool. I've not met Kenny Murdoch yet. Our C-Train narrator is Holly McConnell. And make sure you're following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We're at Sprawl Calgary on all three platforms. You'll want to stay tuned. 2019 is going to be a big year for the Sprawl. We obviously have our provincial election coverage coming, but that's not all. We've got something coming up sooner than that I'm really excited to share with you. So make sure you're following us. Happy New Year, and see you soon. The Sprawl is crowdfunded by Calgarians. If you value independent local journalism, please become a monthly supporter. You can do that at www.patreon.com/sprawlcalgary.